to give talk here. Please interrupt me to ask me questions. And also, if I start writing too small, just say something, because sometimes I tend to go microscopic that one. But okay, so the topic of today, the following. It's going to be a battle between ADS3 gravity, which by ADS3 gravity, I just mean the Einstein-Hilbert action, with negative cosmological constant, and its friendship with Chern-Simons theory with gauge group SO2, comma SO2, which is basically two copies of SO2. Okay, so it will be a purely everything I will say in the next 45 minutes or 40 minutes will entail basically this partnership, this gravitational partnership. And only if you ask me, I will say something about ADS-CFT. But otherwise, this talk is going to be a purely gravitational talk. And so this partnership is not new. It's pretty old. They've been acquainted, these two theories, for a very, very, very long time. And there's many things that they share in common. So just to set up the stage, things that they share are basically their action, which implies that these two theories share the same set of equations of motion. Now, from this point of view, there's two things that you can quite easily do in either formulation, either in the metric formulation or in the Chern-Simons formulation. So one thing that you can do quite well in this context is study, for instance, what is known as the boundary gravitons, which is a key word to understanding the role of boundary conditions in either setup. Okay, so this is pretty clear how to do in the metric formulation. It's pretty clear how to do in the Chern-Simons formulation. No problem. Another thing that is quite clear in both either way that you decide to describe the theories is basically Euclidean black holes, the Euclidean BTC solution. So you can pick your favorite description. You can pick this metric like description or the Chern-Simons description. And there's a very clear understanding of what a Euclidean black hole is in this context. Okay? In particular, things related to thermodynamics. And if you want more geometrically, things related to regularity are pretty well understood. Okay, so at this level, at this stage, it seems like a luxury. Okay, you can either decide to study a spin 2 theory in this metric formulation, or you can decide to understand this theory for a spin 2 excitation in the Chern-Simons formulation. Now, what I'm going to do is focus more on the Chern-Simons side of things, and historically, the reason, so the good part of doing this, so what is nice about focusing on this side is the following. So initially, I started studying quite a lot this Chern-Simons formulation because it allows very naturally for extensions. Okay, so if I wanted to move away from just theories that contain only a spin 2 field, you could easily generalize this to higher spin theories. And there's also generalizations for non-relativistic theories of gravity. Now, in those two nice examples, we don't have a metric counterpart description. But basically, understanding how some basic entropy works allows us to understand aspects and properties of how we would describe those generalizations. What would be the set of observables? What would be their interesting features? And so it's been quite an interesting arena to understand how, for instance, just at the most basic level, these two type of properties kind of extend and broaden as you generalize the theory. Now, there was a promise as well, or at least I was promised when I was a little girl that it was worth studying this. Because I was told that in this Trin-Simons formulation, at least there was the potential of understanding basically what is quantum gravity without geometry. So Trin-Simons theory have appeared like even in the same conference in many different contexts. It's a topological theory. It's a theory where we can have exact results at the perturbative, non-perturbative level. And so this partnership, this relationship between these two theories could potentially teach us something very important about quantum gravity. Now, this is still a promise. And it's a promise that we hope to explore more and more. Now, in order to make this promise concrete, or at least try to understand what happens to this promise, there's another entry that you have to kind of explore, and it will be the focus of what I'm going to say for the rest of this talk. So when we study gravity, like when we study theories based on the Einstein-Hilbert action, despite the fact that this theory is topological, and that's why it's related to this Trin-Simons theory, we still like to think of it in the same way that we think about general relativity in higher dimensions. And so usually here, the focus on this side, and as, for instance, Shira was using in his talk, is a lot about like local properties, local observables. So for example, something that we love to do is to evaluate geodesics. This basically tells us something about what are properties of this space-time, right? It tells us about causal properties. It will tell us about singularities and so forth. We love this language in this context. We also love to compute basically how fields behave in this background. And so something that in the more holographic era that we would do is, for instance, compute something like propagators just to understand like basically how would matter interact in this theory. And these are two things that Trin-Simons does pretty badly. Okay? So the basic question that we had is that if we really want to understand what is the basically the usefulness of this promise here, the question and the challenge that we were trying to address is basically how do you quantify local observables in Trin-Simons? Something maybe as simple as saying what would be a geodesic in the Trin-Simons theory. Okay? How will you test distances? How will you probe that you have a horizon or that you have a singularity? Because Trin-Simons loves topology, but it doesn't like to discuss local things. And so, this is what we're going to do. Okay, we're going to try to understand how will you build, how will you characterize quantities in this context. Any questions? Andy is really looking forward to throwing that mic. Yeah. Very good. So let's continue. So the answer to this question is not too crazy. It's actually quite natural. So let's start talking about basically the title of my talk about Wilson lines. Okay? So what we want to do is consider the following object. So let me first write it, and then I'll tell you what all of these definitions are. So in this theory of transimons, I have basically two copies of SL2 as a gauge group. So I'm writing one connection for each of these two gauge fields that I'll have, A and A bar. This is a Wilson line, meaning that I basically have a curve, gamma, over which I'm integrating the connection, a curve with endpoints at xi and xf. Here, the reason why I'm putting here that the answer only depends on the endpoints is because this is a topological theory. These are flat connections. So actually, the shape of the curve is not important. The only thing that is important is where it starts and where it ends. Okay, then there's a representation R. So as you evaluate a Wilson line, you have to tell us what the representation of the gauge group that we have in mind, this SO2,2 gauge group. And the things that I have here at the endpoints, these are states. In this representation. Okay? So I'm basically computing, if you wish, like a wave function. Okay? This is the object that we're going to study. Now, I'm going to start making various choices because what I want to basically understand with this object, I basically want to understand how can I capture these local properties. Now, the way that we're going to think about this at the most rudimentary level is that I want to think of this Wilson line as a probe. And in this probe, we want to fit the data of a massive, basically, particle. So our basic probe when we're doing studying general relativity is to understand how massive particles, for instance, will kind of travel in a given space-time. And so in this object, I want to fit that data of a massive particle. And without doing any computations or thinking about it too hard, since it's known even from the gauge theory point of view, the representation here is crucial in order to understand where this data fit. Okay? So the way to think about this is that R, the representation, will basically correspond to a Hilbert space for your massive particle, where the Casimir of this representation is basically the mass squared of the probe that you have, okay? And if you think about representations of SL2 times SL2, there's a very basic representation that has a nice feature, basically, where I can have some continuous parameter that fits the mass. And so this instructs me right away that what you should be doing in the case of SL2 is looking to highest weight reps of SL2. Okay, so these states, U roughly speaking, so this highest weight representation basically works as follows. So in SL2, I will have three generators, like L0, L1, L minus 1, a highest weight state is basically a state that has eigenvalue h with respect to L0, is annihilated by L1, and then the descendants of the state up to some normalization are basically L minus 1 that acts like a creation operator acting on that highest weight state. And the quadratic Casimir of this representation is 2h times h minus 1. Okay? That's basically like the conformal dimension of a field. Nothing crazy here. Okay? So these are the representations that we're going to be using. They're infinite dimensional representations. They're unitary representations. Okay? Very good. But this is not quite enough. This gives you at least the hope of like, okay, this parameter here, this is going to be basically the mass squared of this particle. But we have to say a bit more, because I really want to probe these local features. So if you just were to pick one of these, let's say, just out of naiveness, you would tell me, okay, fine, you pick the representation. Pick U to be a direct product. So I have two copies of SL2 because the gauge group is SL2, 2. So you could have said, okay, let's say for each SL2, you pick two of these descendants. So say that you pick these states U to be this. Something that you can, that you don't even need to do any computation at all, is that if you pick your state U to be a direct product of any of these two descendants, it doesn't matter if they're correlated or not, is that this answer is going to collapse. The W of R is basically going to be something that depends on, I'll just be sloppy, I'm not going to keep on writing the path ordered exponentials if I don't have to, but basically it will be the product of these two things. And this doesn't take me anywhere. It's an answer. You can pick that. You can pick that state if you want to. But it doesn't answer my question here. Why does it not answer this question? It's because one of the entries here, I know that as I'm looking at local properties in this in the context of geodesics, we use the metric. If I write down the metric as a function of these connections, I'm not going to keep track of all the indices, but basically, as a function of these connections, the metric is the trace of A minus A bar squared. So basically, when we look at like, okay, what will be the space-time metric in terms of this Chern-Simons formulation, there's two things happening here. One, I'm telling you how to combine these two copies of SL2 by making a choice of what the Lorentz group is, and then requiring you to subtract them, square them, and take the trace. So any local feature that I will ask in the metric formulation necessarily combines the two copies of SL2. It doesn't factorize. The metric is not an object that depends as of A times A bar, okay? It's an object that combines the two copies of SL2 in a non-trivial way. So that's why I'm not happy with that choice there. We did a pretty lousy job, okay? So let's fix this, and this is how we're going to fix it. So we'll keep on using this highest weight representation, but I need more interesting states. So let's introduce a little bit of notation, just to be schematic. So this A here, we usually will write it as a group element L times DL minus L minus 1, an A bar we usually write it as this, where L and R sit inside of SL2. And roughly speaking, let me think of this inner product that I'm computing. I'll also stop writing UI and UF. But roughly speaking, what I'm doing here when I'm computing this Wilson line is that I'm computing basically an overlap between two group elements of the left and the right of each copy of SL2. Okay? That's basically what you're doing. There's, of course, initial and the final point, but there's more group elements here. But there's basically something of the a group element of the left and a group element of the right. Okay? And the thing that this group element, this object here, U, has to do is that it has to make these guys communicate. And it has to make them communicate in a way that I can sort of appreciate why, if you're trying to probe the geometry, is something that communicates both A and A bar. So let me tell you what the answer is, and then we'll motivate a bit the answer. Okay, so states U that will do the trick of combining left and right are basically, so we'll pick states such that if I act on the left and I act on the right on a state, this will look, basically, it will rotate the state U as a bifundamental field, okay? So it will have this action. Now, there's some very simple type of states that satisfy this condition, and one such state, for instance, there's two examples of coherent states. That satisfy this condition. The first one is the cross-cap state, which is a state. Let me first write down what the answer for this guy is. So I can make a choice of U that has the transformation property, where a state that will have this transformation property is a state which basically and a sum over k equal to 0 up to infinity. So it's a state that is a combination. Here, h is the same as h bar. And you're summing over the descendants paired in this way. And this state basically satisfies the equation that L minus a minus L bar minus a acting on u is equal to 0. So this state has this property over here. There's a second state that also has that property, which is an Ishibashi state. So the Ishibashi state is basically is very similar to this one. The difference is that you put a minus 1 to the k here. It's also sum over k, and the equation for it is this equation. Okay. In general, these are two options. In general, you can pick any state that satisfies an equation. This condition will be guaranteed by any state that satisfies an equation of this form, where this operator QA is basically a linear combination of L and L bar, and these are the adjoints of the element U that you're looking at. And so basically here, I just put two examples of this particular coefficient here, but any state that you have that satisfies an equation like this will have this property that it gets rotated in this particular way. So what happens as I do that is that if then you compute this inner product, you can rotate the states around, and they just basically become the overlap between two of these such coherent states. So basically, U is combining how the left acts on the right, and the answer to this Wilson line, let me get it with the signs correct, since I'm being recorded. Okay. So the answer to this, then, this will just be basically a character of SL2. The answer is as simple as that, where H here is entering as the Casimir of this of the representation that you picked, okay, as the weight that you had here. And this object alpha of xi is the geodesic distance on a metric that looks like this. So what U is telling me, the state U here, is basically telling me how you're supposed to relate what is basically the left version of the right moving connection. So its rotation property between the left and the right, basically, in this part of this equation, forces them to combine them. And then the final answer is this parameter alpha, which you can check is just the geodesic distance on this space-time metric. Now, this object over here, furthermore, in the metric formulation, is the bulk-to-bulk propagator of a massive scalar field. Let's call it phi, okay? Where the mass is basically controlled by the conformal dimension. So, okay. So what have we achieved? So there's a few things to notice. I didn't perhaps present all of the details, but basically, these type of coherent states that get rotated very naturally will give you an answer that will look like a propagator for a metric g that depends on how you basically decide to combine a and a bar. Now, from this point of view, there's no preferred choice on the state U that you decide to pick. That's why I'm highlighting at least these two choices. There's more. Just pick any operator QA there that you want that has a non-trivial solution, and you'll be able to do this. Now, of course, there will be subtleties here if this object, if this G mu nu is going to be invertible or not. And so you might care what are the choices of U that you pick here such that you get an invertible metric. Now, when I wrote down that equation there, when I told you, oh, this is how we relate the connections to the gauge field, there's secretly a choice that you're making here about what the Lorentz group is. And that's what this U field is doing here. It's going to tell you how out of this two copies of SL2, you're going to characterize a diagonal SL2 that is the frame rotations of the Einbinds. And from that point of view, if you like the usual choice of a Lorentz frame in the metric formulation, the U that you should pick is this Ishibashi state. Okay? But you could have made a different choice. You could have picked the cross-cap state, and at the level of this discussion, Chern-Simons really doesn't care. Okay? You can have done any one of them. But the natural, the more conventional choice is this Ishibashi choice. So very good. So what this computation basically shows is that there's a very natural way how to probe the geometry and how to probe it using this Wilson line. The Wilson line contains the information of the bulk to bulk propagator. So what have we done with this? Is there any questions so far? Nope. Yeah, okay. I'll write it again if you guys need. So application. So initially, just historically, the first reason why we were studying this was for the purpose on ADS3 to basically have a way how to quantify. We put the endpoints of the Wilson line at the boundary of ADS3. And if you do that, then this Wilson line you can show quite nicely that it basically computes for you a correlation function of two light operators and two, sorry, let me write them heavy like this. So it computes for you a correlation function of two heavy operators that basically the heavy operator is whatever background you put for A, and the light operator is basically the state U. So when you take the endpoints of the Wilson line to the boundary, it computes for you this correlation function. So that's one nice thing. The second use, more geometrically, is to now say, okay, now I have a way how to explore local properties in Chern-Simons theory. I can try to understand how will you detect horizons, how will you detect basically other boundaries. So the second application is in the context of eternal black holes. This was particularly relevant in the context of higher spin theories, but basically trying to understand my square is not going to be super squarish, but okay, that's a black hole. but basically, understanding what are the properties if you anchor now this Wilson line from one boundary to the other, and as a correlation function imposing the KMS conditions.
on W of R.
And that gave us a way how, for instance, to detect the bifurcation point, basically. Where would the horizon be located in this language of transymus? Okay, the connections themselves don't know about this. If you just write down A, there's no special point. Even if you write it for the BTC black hole, if you evaluate any of these two connections at R+, they're completely regular. They don't care. There's no special point in here. But the Wilson line does care. And it had a notion of bifurcation point. The third application this is, it's more an observation. It was in relationship to black hole entropy. So it's kind of cute that you can evaluate this Wilson line around a loop. So then it's actually fully gauge invariant. Notice this object depends on the endpoints. There's data at the endpoints that you have to impose. But if you compute the Wilson loop, if you actually compute a loop around the black hole, then this thing basically gives you the entropy of the black hole times the mass of the particle and multiplied by a one loop determinant of the fields, basically. Of these scalar fields going around that loop, okay? And this works not just for the case of Einstein-Hilbert, like the case of SO2,2. If you do it for higher spin theories, it also captures the entropy of the higher spin black holes. But okay, in that case, I'm not computing geodesic distances, but it's actually a more complicated object that you have there. The fourth thing is to look at junctions. And in that context, so let me draw now ADS, put a constant time slice on ADS. You can do a junction. For instance, you have three lines where two endpoints are at the boundary, and then you just have one endpoint, like one of the Wilson lines just finishing here in the bulk somewhere. This in the metric formulation corresponds to what's known as a geodesic Witten diagram, where this point here is integrated over a geodesic that connects the two endpoints. So the junctions as well have an interpretation in terms of the metric formulation. If you do more junctions, let's say now, if you do something like this, like two junctions of the Wilson lines. For those of you that are not blocked by the by the thing there, any wild guess that this would correspond to? Well, it will correspond to the geodesic Witten diagram with both lines projected, and that's basically. My circles are not very good, but okay, who cares? So then you're projecting over these two geodesics, and in the dual CFT, that's a conformal block. Okay, so there was also known that Wilson lines be related to conformal block. So that's things that you can do with junctions. So in the last minute, you can say, okay, this is great. You answer the question. We're good to go. The promise, let's just quantize this transymus theory and we'll figure out what quantum gravity is. Now, there is also an issue, and it's that it is true. So the fifth thing that has been done is to compute there's multiple groups that looked at like quantum corrections to W of R, because here, in the context of what I've been talking about in this talk, the connections A and A bar are treated classically. I'm not quantizing ANA bar. But there have been at least three groups that have looked at, like, okay, what happens if you actually quantize A and A bar? And what they did was basically look at a Wilson line that went from one endpoint to the other of the boundary. And the quantum corrections basically will correspond schematically to gravitons going around in loops. And they're pretty good at doing this. There's computations up to three loops. One thing that I can say right now is that this is not the same thing that you would get if you, let me draw it in blue, just to kind of make a point that if you looked at a Witten diagram with a graviton going through it, it will not be the same answer. So this is still one of, like, the open questions that we have. So at the classical level, we're getting a lot of mileage and trying to understand, okay, how really can we explore this partnership? Quantization in this context is much easier. It's much, much more doable. But we're having some tensions here. So this talk will end in an unsatisfactory tone, saying that, yeah, we still don't know if the promise will be fulfilled. So it's to be explored. So with that, let me just finish it, and any questions?
So in higher spin theories, like in SL3 cross SL3, where black hole horizons in the metric are gauge dependent, does this allow you to
pick the
location of the horizon?
So in the context of this point number two, yeah, we worked it out for the SL3 times SL3 case. And there is a horizon. It depends on the, there's a non-trivial choice of the radial part of the gauge field.
Picks a preferred gauge.
Yeah, it picks a preferred gauge. In some sense, it's not so surprising. It's basically a construction or a definition of what Kruskal coordinates are in the higher spin context. So this basically gives you a way how to build Kruskal coordinates in higher spin theories and understand basically what will be the properties, the Lorentzian properties of a given solution. We are also trying to understand the propagator in more detail and understand what are causal properties of this bulk-to-bulk propagator. Because in the context of SL3 times SL3, it gives us a fully gauge covariant way how to couple a field to a higher spin background that is non-trivial, like the higher spin black hole. So it's it's a little bit complicated. I have a student sweating over this, but it's a well-defined problem now. Like, we can understand locality in higher spin theories.
So just to summarize, which of your observables are gauge invariant and which are not with respect to gauge transformations in the bulk and on the boundary?
Yeah, this is the only one that is gauge invariant, the loop.
So the loop is, and the others?
This is not gauge invariant. This depends on the endpoint. So you have to specify data at the endpoint. It's sensitive to the endpoints of the Wilson line. It's gauge. It transforms covariantly, but
In ordinary Chern-Simons theory, you're instructed not to study the observable.
This usually, like the traditional Chern-Simons literature, will not study this. No. So that's why we kind of have to a little bit reinvent the wheel, because people shy away from these objects. But in some sense, we needed to study this if we wanted to address some of this. Now, gravity, of course, also doesn't have gauge invariant observable. So it's always the problem of, like, okay, what do we quantify in the metric formulation in the gravitational theory? And so I need to allow for, like, this type of objects that are coordinate dependent, are gauge dependent. And this is the object that is replacing that.
Okay, so usually quantization of Chern-Simon theories are maybe affected by framing ambiguities, okay? Do you see any effect? Maybe this might go in the direction of solving your question marks.
Not yet. This is actually, it's kind of interesting that this side of this equation hasn't been studied. The braiding, I don't see it coming in here. I don't think that's the particular issue. In the case, just independently, I was talking a lot about SO2,2, but in the case of SU2 or SO4, that's a case where we have understood those effects a bit better. And there's going to be more to come, because in SU2 Chern-Simons theory, there's a lot of results. In SL2 Chern-Simons theory, there's a bit less from that point of view. But that is not coming in here yet. It might be something to look forward to, but the thing that I'm surprised is that this computation on the metric formulation has never been done. Although the graviton is topological in some sense, it does make sense to do this computation. They will not agree. That I know.
Any other questions? If not, let's thank Alejandra again.